he had earned the right to be trusted with power. He could also argue, as he did to several friends throughout his first term, that no man was more poised for retirement, that he sincerely resented the obligations of his office as a lengthening shadow of public responsibility that kept spreading over his dwindling days on earth. If critics wished to whisper behind his back that he looked too regal riding a white stallion with a leopard-skin cloth and gold-rimmed saddle, so be it. He himself knew that he longed for a crabtree walking stick more than a scepter. In the meantime, he would play his assigned role as America's presiding presence. Or, as the multiple toasts in his honor put it, the man who unites all hearts. The Great Delegator. Exercising executive authority calls for a completely different set of leadership skills than symbolizing it. Washington's administrative style had evolved through decades of experience as master of Mount Vernon and commander of the Continental Army. In fact, he had fewer subordinates to supervise as president than he did in those earlier incarnations. The cabinet system he installed represented a civilian adaptation of his military staff, with executive sessions of the cabinet resembling councils of war designed to provide collective wisdom in a crisis. As Jefferson later described the arrangement, Washington made himself the hub of the wheel, with routine business delegated to the department heads at the rim. It was a system that maximized executive control while also creating the essential distance from details. Its successful operation depended upon two acquired skills Washington had developed over his lengthy career. First, identifying and recruiting talented and ambitious young men, usually possessing superior formal education to his own, then trusting them with considerable responsibility and treating them as surrogate sons in his official family. Second, knowing when to remain the hedgehog who keeps his distance and when to become the fox who dives into the details. On the first score, as a judge of talent, Washington surrounded himself with the most intellectually sophisticated collection of statesmen in American presidential history. His first recruit, James Madison, became his most trusted consultant on judicial and executive appointments and his unofficial liaison with Congress. The Virginian was then at the peak of his powers, having just completed a remarkable string of triumphs as the dominant force behind the nationalist agenda at the Constitutional Convention and the Virginia Ratifying Convention, as well as co-author of the Federalist Papers. From his position in the House of Representatives, he drafted the address welcoming Washington to the presidency, then drafted Washington's response to it, making him a one-man shadow government. Madison's unique combination of abilities as a profound student of politics and a brilliant political tactician had captured Washington's attention even before the debates in Philadelphia, when he had helped to prepare Washington for his chairman's role in the convention. Soon after the inaugural ceremony, Madison showed Washington his draft of 12 amendments to the Constitution, subsequently reduced to 10 and immortalized as the Bill of Rights. Washington approved the historic proposal without changing a word, and trusted Madison to usher it through Congress with his customary proficiency. One of Madison's early assignments was to persuade his reluctant friend from Monticello to serve as Secretary of State. Thomas Jefferson combined nearly spotless revolutionary credentials with 5 years of diplomatic experience in Paris, all buoyed by a lyrical way with words and ideas, most famously displayed in his draft of the Declaration of Independence. Though ironic in retrospect, Jefferson's acceptance letter set a deferential tone and expressed a willingness to harness his vaunted powers to Washington's foreign policy agenda. "My chief comfort," he promised, "will be to work under your eye, and the wisdom of measures to be dictated by you and implicitly executed by me." Alexander Hamilton was the third member of this talented trinity. In terms of sheer brain power, probably the brightest of the lot. While Madison and Jefferson had come up through the Virginia School of Politics, which put a premium on an understated style that emphasized indirection and stealth, Hamilton had come out of nowhere, actually impoverished origins in the Caribbean, which produced a dashing, out-of-my-way style that imposed itself ostentatiously, much in the manner of the bayonet charge he had led at Yorktown. As Washington's aide-de-camp during the war, Hamilton had occasionally shown himself to be a somewhat feisty and headstrong surrogate son, always searching for an independent command beyond Washington's shadow. But his loyalty to his mentor was unquestioned, and his affinity for the way Washington thought was unequaled. Moreover, throughout the 1780s, Hamilton had made himself the chief advocate for fiscal reform as the essential prerequisite for an energetic national government, making him the obvious choice as Secretary of Treasury once Robert Morris declined. The inner circle was rounded out with three appointments of lesser luster. Henry Knox had served alongside Washington from the Boston siege to Yorktown, and had long ago learned to subsume his own personality so thoroughly within his chief's that disagreements became virtually impossible. More than a cipher, as some critics of Washington's policies later claimed, Knox joined Vice President Adams as a seasoned New England voice within the councils of power. Indeed, his role as Secretary of War continued the duties he had performed in the old Confederation government. John Jay added New York's most distinguished legal and political mind to the mix, and also brought extensive foreign policy experience to the ongoing conversation. As the first Attorney General, Edmund Randolph lacked the gravitas of Jay and the experience of Knox, but his reputation for endless vacillations was offset by solid political connections with the Tidewater elite, reinforced by impeccable bloodlines. Washington's judgment of the assembled team was unequivocal. "I feel myself supported by able coadjutors," he observed in June 1790, "who harmonize extremely well together." In three significant areas of domestic policy, each loaded with explosive political and constitutional implications, Washington chose to delegate nearly complete control to his coadjutors. His reasons for maintaining a discreet distance differed in each case, but taken together, they reflected his recognition that executive power still lived under a monarchical cloud of suspicion and could only be exercised selectively. Much like his Fabian role during the war, choosing when to avoid conflict struck him as the essence of effective executive leadership, especially when he enjoyed capable surrogates brimming over with energy and ambition. The first battle he evaded focused on the shape and powers of the federal courts. The Constitution offered even less guidance on the judiciary than it did on the executive branch. And once again, the studied ambiguity reflected the widespread apprehension toward any menacing projection of federal power that upset the compromise between state and federal sovereignty. Washington personally preferred a unified body of national law, regarding it as a crucial step in the creation of what the Constitution had described as a more perfect union. When nominating Jay to head the Supreme Court, he argued that the federal judiciary must be considered as the keystone of our political fabric, since a coherent court system that tied the states and regions together with the ligaments of law would achieve more in the way of national unity than any other possible reform. But that, of course, was also the reason why it proved so controversial. The debate over the Judiciary Act of 1789 exposed the latent hostility toward any consolidated court system. The Act created a 6-member Supreme Court, 3 circuit courts, and 13 district courts, but left questions of original or appellate jurisdiction intentionally blurred so as to conciliate the advocates of state sovereignty. Despite his personal preferences, Washington deferred to the trade-offs worked out in congressional committees, chiefly a committee chaired by Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, which designed a framework of overlapping authorities that was neither rational nor wholly national in scope. In subsequent decades, John Marshall, Washington's most loyal and influential disciple, would move this ambiguous arrangement toward a more coherent version of national law. But throughout Washington's presidency, the one thing the Supreme Court could not be or appear to be was supreme, a political reality that Washington chose not to contest. A second occasion for calculated executive reticence occurred in February 1790, when the forbidden subject of slavery came before Congress. 2 Quaker petitions, one arguing for the immediate end of the slave trade, the other advocating the gradual abolition of slavery itself, provoked a bitter debate in the House. The petitions would almost surely have been consigned to legislative oblivion except for the signature of Benjamin Franklin on the 2nd, which transformed a beyond-the-pale protest into an unavoidable challenge to debate the moral compatibility of slavery with America's avowed revolutionary principles. In what turned out to be his last public act, Franklin was investing his great prestige to force the first public discussion of the sectional differences over slavery at the national level. The debates at the Constitutional Convention had occurred behind closed doors, and even the sanitized record of those debates remained sealed in the vaults of the State Department. If only in retrospect, the debates in the House during the spring of 1790 represented the final opportunity on the part of the revolutionary generation to place slavery on the road to ultimate extinction. Washington shared Franklin's views on slavery as a moral and political anachronism. On 3 occasions during the 1780s, he had let it be known that he favored the adoption of some kind of gradual emancipation scheme, and would give his personal support to such a scheme whenever it materialized. Warner Mifflin, one of the Quaker petitioners who knew of Washington's previous statements, obtained a private interview in order to plead that this was now the ideal occasion for Washington to step forward in the manner of Franklin. And since he was the only American with more prestige than Franklin, Washington's intervention at this propitious moment could make the decisive difference in removing this stain on the revolutionary legacy as well as his own. We can never know what might have happened if Washington had taken this advice. He listened politely to Mifflin's request, but refused to commit himself on the grounds that the matter was properly the province of Congress and might come before me for official decision. He struck a more cynical tone in letters to friends back in Virginia. The introduction of the Quaker memorial rejecting slavery was, to be sure, not only an ill-judged piece of business, but occasioned a great waste of time. He endorsed Madison's deft management of the debate and his behind-the-scenes maneuvering in the House, which voted to prohibit any further consideration of ending the slave trade until 1808, as the Constitution specified. More significantly, Madison managed to take slavery off the national agenda by making any legislation seeking to end it a state rather than federal prerogative. Washington expressed his satisfaction that the threatening subject has at last been put to sleep, and will scarcely awake before the year 1808. What strikes us as a poignant failure of moral leadership appeared to Washington as a prudent exercise in political judgment. There is no evidence that he struggled over the decision. Whatever his personal views on slavery may have been, his highest public priority was the creation of a unified American nation. The debates in the House only dramatized the intractable sectional differences he had witnessed from the chair at the Constitutional Convention. They reinforced his conviction that slavery was the one issue with the political potential to destroy the Republican experiment in its infancy. With one important difference, he embraced Madison's resolution of the crisis, which established a moratorium on the subject at the federal level for the foreseeable future. In Washington's view, the moratorium should last until 1808, when the larger subject of slavery could be taken up with the ending of the slave trade. But until then, and surely for the remainder of his presidency, the issue was too controversial to risk executive involvement and too combustible to talk about publicly at all. Despite the vows of public silence, the taboo topic came up in an awkwardly personal way the following year, soon after the federal government made its scheduled move from New York to Philadelphia. Attorney General Randolph alerted Washington to the awkward fact that Pennsylvania law allowed any slave who was resident for 6 months within the state to demand emancipation. Washington asked Tobias Lear to look into the law in order to determine if the 6-month rule could be skirted by removing his household slaves to Mount Vernon before the time expired, then returning them to Philadelphia to start the clock again. Part of his concern was financial, since the loss of any dower slaves would require him to reimburse the Custis estate. He was especially concerned with losing two of his most trusted slaves, Hercules and Paris. He instructed Lear to have Martha take them back with her to Mount Vernon, but without letting anyone except Martha know the motive for the trip. "I wish to both have it accomplished under pretext that may deceive both them and the public," he confided to Lear. When Hercules got wind of the scheme, he expressed a sense of personal insult that his loyalty to Washington was not taken for granted. Eventually, Hercules was allowed to stay in Philadelphia, where he remained Washington's highly valued cook until the end of the second presidential term, at which point he absconded, much to Washington's surprise and chagrin. The incident served to expose the widening gap on the slavery question north and south of the Potomac, as well as the gap between Washington's professed convictions about slavery and his dependence on enslaved servants. Finally, the most dramatic delegation of all, Washington gave total responsibility for rescuing the debt-burdened American economy to his charismatic Secretary of Treasury. Before Hamilton was appointed in September 1789, Washington had requested financial records from the old Confederation government and quickly discovered that he had inherited a messy mass of state, domestic, and foreign debt. The records were filled with floating bond rates, complicated currency conversion tables, and guesswork revenue projections that, taken together, resembled an accountant's worst nightmare. The world in which fortunes were made and lost against a background of shuffling papers and shifting numbers felt to him like a foreign country. This was one reason he always suspected that Carey and Company was cheating him in the pre-revolutionary days. After making a heroic effort of his own that only confirmed his sense of futility, Washington handed the records and fiscal policy of the new nation to his former aide-de-camp, who turned out to be, among other things, a financial genius. Hamilton buried himself in the numbers for 3 months, then emerged with a 40,000-word document entitled Report on Public Credit. His calculations revealed that the total debt of the United States had reached the daunting, for then, size of $77.1 million, which was divided into three separate ledgers. Foreign debt, $11.7 million, federal debt, $40.4 million, and state debt, $25 million. Several generations of historians and economists have analyzed the intricacies of Hamilton's report and created a formidable body of scholarship on its technical complexities. For our purposes, however, it is sufficient to know that Hamilton's calculations were accurate and his strategy simple. Namely, consolidate the messy columns of foreign and domestic debt into one central pile. He proposed funding the federal debt at par, assuming all the state debts, then creating a national bank to manage all the investments and payments at the federal level. This made excellent economic sense, as the improved credit rating of the United States in foreign banks and the surging productivity of the commercial sector demonstrated after Hamilton's financial plan was adopted. But it also proved to be a political bombshell that shook Congress for over a year with its reverberations. For Hamilton had managed to create, almost single-handedly, an unambiguously national economic policy that presumed the sovereign power of the federal government. He had pursued a bolder course than the more cautious framers of the Judiciary Act had followed in designing the court system, leaving no doubt that control over fiscal policy would not be brokered to accommodate the states. All three ingredients in his plan, funding, assumption, and the bank, were vigorously contested in Congress, with Madison, an ominous sign, leading the opposition on each front. The watchword of the critics was consolidation, an ideological cousin to monarchy, both terms suggesting a threatening aggregation of political power, reminiscent of the tyrannical British government that the American colonies had defied and then overthrown. There was also a sectional edge to the criticism, especially the Virginia version, which described Hamilton's financial plan as a hostile takeover of the American Revolution by Northern bankers and speculators. "In an agricultural country like this," Virginia's governor wrote to Washington, "to erect and concentrate and perpetuate a large insured interest must in the course of human events produce one or other of two evils, the prostration of agriculture at the feet of commerce, or a change in the present form of federal government fatal to the existence of American liberty." Washington did not respond. Indeed, he played no public role at all in defending Hamilton's program during the fierce congressional debates. For his part, Hamilton never requested presidential advice or assistance, regarding control over his own bailiwick as a commander's responsibility. A reader of the correspondence between them might plausibly conclude that the important topics of business were the location and staffing of lighthouses and the proper design of Coast Guard cutters to enforce customs collections. Privately, Washington confided to friends that he deeply regretted the accusations emanating from his home state, which were poisoning the minds of the Southern people. Virginia's veiled threats at secession struck him as desperate gestures on the part of a state that needed to reassess its own inflated sense of importance. But no public statements were necessary, in part because Hamilton was a one-man army in defending his program, a host unto himself, as Jefferson later called him. And by February 1791, the last piece of the Hamiltonian scheme, the bank, had been passed by Congress and now only required the presidential signature. But the bank proved to be the one controversial issue that Washington could not completely delegate to Hamilton. As a symbol, it was every bit as threatening, as palpable an embodiment of federal power, as a sovereign Supreme Court. As part of a last-ditch campaign to scuttle the bank, the three Virginians within Washington's official family mobilized to attack it on constitutional grounds. Jefferson, Madison, and Randolph submitted separate briefs, all arguing that the power to create a corporation was nowhere specified by the Constitution, and that the 10th Amendment clearly specified that powers not granted to the federal government were retained by the states. Before rendering his own verdict, Washington sent the three negative opinions to Hamilton for rebuttal. His response, which exceeded 13,000 words, became a landmark in American legal history. Arguing that the Necessary and Proper Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, granted implied powers to the federal government beyond the explicit powers specified in the document. Madison, ironically, had made the same argument 3 years earlier in the Federalist Papers. Though there is some evidence that Washington was wavering before Hamilton delivered his opinion, it was not the brilliance of the opinion that persuaded him. Rather, it provided the legal rationale he needed to do what he always wanted to do. For the truth was that Washington was just as much an economic nationalist as Hamilton, a fact that Hamilton's virtuoso leadership throughout the year-long debate had conveniently obscured. The Imperial Presidency. As both a symbolic political centerpiece and a deft delegator of responsibility, Washington managed to levitate above the political landscape. That was his preferred position. Personally, because it made his natural aloofness into an asset, politically because it removed the presidency from the edgy partisan battles on the ground. In three policy areas, however, the location of the national capital, foreign policy, and Indian affairs, he abandoned levitation or delegation for meticulous personal management in the mode of his Mount Vernon leadership style. What was called the residence question had its origins in a provision of the Constitution calling for Congress to establish a seat of government without specifying the location. By the spring of 1790, the debates in Congress had deteriorated into a comic parody on the gridlock theme. 16 different sites had been proposed, then rejected, as the state and regional voting blocs mobilized against each alternative in order to preserve their own respective preferences. One frustrated congressman suggested sarcastically that perhaps they should put the new capital on wheels and roll it from place to place. An equally frustrated newspaper editor observed that, since the usual custom is for the capital of new empires to be selected by the whim or caprice of a despot, and since Washington had never given bad advice to his country, why not let him point to a map and say, "Here"? That is not quite how the Potomac site emerged victorious. Madison had been leading the fight in the House for a Potomac location, earning the nickname Big Knife for cutting deals to block the other alternatives. One of Madison's most inspired arguments was that the geographic midpoint of the nation on a north-south axis was not just the mouth of the Potomac, but Mount Vernon itself, a revelation of providential proportions. Eventually, a private bargain was struck over dinner at Jefferson's apartment, subsequently enshrined in lore as the most consequential dinner party in American history, where Hamilton agreed to deliver sufficient votes from several northern states to clinch the Potomac location, in return for Madison's pledge to permit passage of Hamilton's Assumption Bill. Actually, there were multiple behind-the-scenes bargaining sessions going on at the same time. But the notion that an apparently intractable political controversy could be resolved by a friendly conversation over port and cigars has always possessed an irresistible narrative charm. The story also conjured up the attractive picture of brotherly cooperation within his official family that Washington liked to encourage. Soon after the Residency Act, designating a Potomac location, passed in July 1790, the previous suggestion of the newspaper editor, that is, give the messy question to Washington, became fully operative. Jefferson feared that the Potomac site would be sabotaged if the endless management details for developing a city de novo were left to Congress. So he proposed a thoroughly imperial solution. Bypass Congress altogether by making all subsequent decisions about architects, managers, and construction schedules an executive responsibility subject to the president's direction in every point. And so they were. What became Washington, D.C. was aptly named. For while the project had many troops involved in its design and construction, it had only one supreme commander. He selected the specific site on the Potomac between Rock Creek and Goose Creek, rather deceptively pretending to prefer a more upstream location in order to hold down the purchase price for lots in the ultimate site. He appointed the commissioners, who reported directly to him rather than Congress. He chose Pierre L'Enfant as chief architect, personally endorsing L'Enfant's plan for a huge tract encompassing 9.5 square miles, thereby rejecting Jefferson's preference for a small village that would gradually expand in favor of a massive area that would gradually fill up. When L'Enfant's grandiose vision led to equivalently grandiose demands, he refused to take orders from the commissioners and responded to one stubborn owner of a key lot by blowing up his house, Washington fired him. He approved the sites for the presidential mansion and the Capitol, as well as the architects who designed them. All in all, he treated the nascent national capital as a public version of his Mount Vernon plantation, right down to the supervision of the slave labor force that did much of the work. It helped that the construction site was located near Mount Vernon, so he could make regular visits to monitor progress on his way home. It also helped that Jefferson and Madison could confer with him at the site on their trips back to Monticello and Montpelier. At a time when both Virginians were leading the opposition to Hamilton's financial program, their cooperation on this ongoing project served to bridge the widening chasm within the official family over the Hamiltonian vision of federal power. However therapeutic the cooperation, it belied a fundamental disagreement over the political implications of their mutual interests in the federal city, as it was then called. For Jefferson and Madison regarded the Potomac location of the permanent capital as a guarantee of Virginia's abiding hegemony within the Union, as a form of geographic assurance that the federal government would always speak with a Southern accent. Washington thought more expansively, envisioning the capital as a focusing device for national energies that overcame regional jealousies. In effect, a place that would perform the same unifying function geographically that he performed symbolically. His personal hobby horse became a national university within the capital, where the brightest young men from all regions could congregate and share a common experience as Americans that helped to rub off their sectional habits and accents. His hands-on approach toward foreign policy was only slightly less direct than his control of the Potomac Project. The major foreign policy crisis of the Washington presidency did not occur until his second term, but the basic principles underlying his view of the national interest were present from the start, and he showed no reluctance in imposing them as the elemental convictions he had acquired from long experience in two wars for control of the North American continent. Most elementally, he was a thoroughgoing realist. Though he embraced Republican ideals, he believed that the behavior of nations was not driven by ideals, but by interests. This put him at odds ideologically and temperamentally with his Secretary of State, since Jefferson was one of the most eloquent spokesmen for the belief that American ideals were American interests. Jefferson's recent experience in Paris, as a witness to the onset of the French Revolution, had only confirmed his conviction that a global struggle on behalf of those ideals had just begun, and that it had a moral claim on American support. Washington was pleased to receive the key to the Bastille from Lafayette. He also knew as well as or better than anyone else that the victory over Great Britain would have been impossible without French economic and military assistance. But he was determined to prevent his personal affection for Lafayette or his warm memories of Rochambeau's soldiers and de Grasse's ships at Yorktown from influencing his judgment about the long-term interests of the United States. Those interests, he was convinced, did not lie across the Atlantic, but across the Alleghenies, in those forests and fields he had explored as a young man. To be sure, Europe was the cockpit of international affairs and the central theater in the ongoing Anglo-French struggle for global supremacy. But Washington regarded Europe as only a sideshow that must not divert attention from the enduring strategic interests of the United States. The chief task, as he saw it, was to consolidate control of the continent east of the Mississippi. Although Jefferson had never been west of the Blue Ridge Mountains, he shared Washington's preference for western vistas. During his own presidency, Jefferson would do more than anyone to expand those vistas beyond the Mississippi to the Pacific. Both men regarded Spanish presence in Florida and the Mississippi Valley as a temporary occupation by a declining European power that was destined to be overwhelmed by waves of American settlers within two or three generations. Tight presidential control over foreign policy was unavoidable at the start, because Jefferson did not come on board until March 1790. Washington immediately delegated all routine business to him, but preserved his own private lines of communication on French developments, describing reports of escalating bloodshed he received from Paris as if they were the events of another planet. He kept up a joke with Rochambeau about hot soup. The French were inclined to swallow it in huge gulps, they agreed, thereby burning their throats. The Americans preferred to sip it slowly, after it had cooled. This cautionary posture toward revolutionary France received reinforcement from Governor Morris, the willfully eccentric and thoroughly irreverent American in Paris, whom Washington cultivated as a correspondent. Morris minced no words, or perhaps designed them to maximize their political impact. He described France's revolutionary leaders as a fleet at anchor in the fog, and he dismissed Jefferson's view that a Gallic version of 1776 was underway as a hopelessly romantic illusion. The American Revolution, Morris observed, had been guided by experience and light, while the French were obsessed with experiment and lightning. Morris's reports on the unfolding chaos eventually became invaluable documents in the historical record, famous for their combination of detachment and wit. Washington relied on them for accurate intelligence and eventually appointed Morris the American minister to France over Senate opposition to his iconoclastic style. For his part, Morris returned the favor. Despite having a peg leg, he was a robust physical specimen who posed for Udon as Washington's stand-in when the sculptor needed a model to complete the statue of his more famous subject. In addition to his personal monitoring of the explosive events in France, Washington's supervisory style, as well as his realistic foreign policy convictions, were put on display when a potential crisis surfaced in the summer of 1790. A minor incident involving Great Britain and Spain in Nootka Sound, near modern-day Vancouver, prompted a major appraisal of American national interests. The British appeared poised to use the incident to launch an invasion from Canada down the Mississippi designed to displace Spain as the dominant European power in the American West. This threatened to change the entire strategic chemistry on the continent and raised the daunting prospect of another major war with Great Britain. Washington convened his cabinet in executive session, thereby making clear for the first time that the cabinet, and not the more cumbersome Senate, would be his advisory council on foreign policy. Written opinions were solicited from all the major players, including Adams, Hamilton, Jay, Jefferson, and Knox. The crisis fizzled away when the British decided to back off, but during the deliberations, two revealing facts became clear. First, that Washington was resolved to avoid war at any cost, convinced that the fragile American Republic was neither militarily nor economically capable of confronting the British Leviathan at this time. Second, that Hamilton's strategic assessment, not Jefferson's, was more closely aligned with his own, which turned out to be a preview of coming attractions. Strictly speaking, the federal government's relations with the Native American tribes were also a foreign policy matter. From the start, however, Indian affairs came under the authority of the Secretary of War. As ominous as this might appear in retrospect, Jefferson's late arrival on the scene effectively forced Knox to assume responsibility for negotiating the disputed terms of several treaties approved by the Confederation Congress. More significantly, for both personal and policy reasons, Washington wanted his own hand firmly on this particular tiller, and his intimate relationship with Knox assured a seamless coordination guided by his own judgment. He had been present at the start of the struggle for control of the American interior, and regarded the final fate of the Indian inhabitants as an important piece of unfinished business that must not be allowed to end on a tragic note. At the policy level, if America's future lay to the west, as Washington believed, it followed that the region between the Alleghenies and the Mississippi merited executive attention more than the diplomatic doings in Europe. Knox estimated that about 76,000 Native Americans lived in the region, about 20,000 of them warriors, which meant that venerable tribal chiefs like Corn Planter and Joseph Brant deserved more cultivation as valuable allies than heads of state across the Atlantic. At the personal level, as commander of the Virginia Regiment and then alongside Braddock at the Monongahela, Washington had experienced Indian power firsthand. He did not view Native Americans as exotic savages, but as familiar and formidable adversaries, fighting for their own independence, in effect, behaving pretty much as he would do in their place. Moreover, the letters the new president received from several tribal chiefs provided poignant testimony that they now regarded him as their personal protector. "Brother," wrote one Cherokee chief, "we give up to our white brothers all the land we could anyhow spare and have but little left, and we hope you won't let any people take any more from us without our consent. We are neither birds nor fish. We can neither fly in the air nor live under water. We are made by the same hand and in the same shape as yourselves." Such pleas did not fall on deaf ears. Working closely with Knox, Washington devised a policy designed to create several sovereign Indian homelands. He concurred when Knox insisted that the independent tribes of Indians ought to be considered as foreign nations, not as the subjects of any particular state. Treaties with these tribes ought to be regarded as binding contracts sanctioned by the federal government, whose jurisdiction could not be compromised. Indians, being the prior occupants, possess the right of the soil. To dispossess them would be a gross violation of the fundamental laws of nature and of that distributive justice which is the glory of a nation. A more coercive policy of outright confiscation, Washington believed, would constitute a moral failure that would stain the character of the nation. He sought to avoid the outcome, Indian removal, that occurred more than 40 years later under Andrew Jackson. Instead, he envisioned multiple sanctuaries under tribal control that would be bypassed by the surging wave of white settlers and whose occupants would gradually, over the course of the next century, become assimilated as full-fledged American citizens. Attempting to make this vision a reality occupied more of Washington's time and energy than any foreign or domestic issue during his first term. Success depended on identifying key tribal leaders willing to negotiate and capable of imposing the settlement on other tribes in the region. Knox and Washington identified one charismatic Creek chief named Alexander McGillivray, a literate half-breed with diplomatic skills and survival instincts that made him the Indian version of France's Talleyrand on the southern frontier. In the summer of 1790, Washington hosted McGillivray and 26 chiefs for several weeks of official dinners, parades, and diplomatic ceremonies, more lavish than any European delegation experienced. McGillivray expected and received a personal bribe of $1,200 a year to offset the sum the Spanish were already paying him not to negotiate with the Americans. Washington and the chiefs locked arms in Indian style and invoked the Great Spirit. Then the chiefs made their marks on the Treaty of New York, redrawing the borders for a sovereign Creek nation. Washington reinforced the terms of the treaty by issuing the Proclamation of 1790, an executive order forbidding private or state encroachments on all Indian lands guaranteed by treaty with the United States. Ironically, it was a presidential version of George III's Proclamation of 1763, which a younger Washington had found so offensive. But much like George III, Washington soon found that it was one thing to proclaim and quite another to sustain. The Georgia legislature defied the proclamation by making a thoroughly corrupt bargain to sell more than 15 million acres on its western border to speculators calling themselves the Yazoo Companies, thereby rendering the Treaty of New York a worthless piece of paper. In the northern district above the Ohio, no equivalent to McGillivray could be found, mostly because the Six Nations, which Washington could remember as a potent force in the region, had been virtually destroyed in the War of Independence and could no longer exercise hegemony over the Ohio Valley tribes. Washington was forced to approve a series of military expeditions into the Ohio Valley to put down uprisings by the Miami, Wyandot, and Shawnee, even though he believed that the chief culprits were white vigilante groups determined to provoke hostilities. The Indian side of the story, Washington complained, would never make it into the history books. "They, poor wretches, have no press through which their grievances are related, and it is well known that when one side only of a story is heard and often repeated, the human mind becomes impressed with it insensibly." Worse still, the expedition commanded by Arthur St. Clair was virtually annihilated in the fall of 1791. Reading St. Clair's battle orders is like watching Custer prepare for the Little Bighorn, thereby creating white martyrs and provoking congressional cries for reprisals in what had become an escalating cycle of violence that defied Washington's efforts at conciliation. Eventually, Washington was forced to acknowledge that his vision of secure Indian sanctuaries could not be enforced. "I believe scarcely anything short of a Chinese wall," he lamented, "will restrain land jobbers and the encroachment of settlers upon the Indian country." Knox concurred, estimating that federal control on the frontier would require an arc of forts stretching from Lake Erie to the Gulf of Mexico and garrisoned by no fewer than 50,000 troops. This was a logistical, economic, and political impossibility. Washington's vision of peaceful coexistence also required that federal jurisdiction over the states as the ultimate guarantor of all treaties be recognized as supreme, which helps to explain why he was so passionate about the issue, but also why it could never happen. If a just accommodation with the Native American populations was the major preoccupation of his first term, it was also the singular failure. Parties and partisans. What Washington had once imagined as a brief caretaker presidency lasting a year or two had by 1792 grown into a judicious projection of executive power that was nearing the end of its designated term. He had performed his central mission flawlessly, providing invaluable legitimacy to the more perfect Union that was still, in truth, a work in progress. He had demonstrated many of the same leadership skills in the political arena that he had previously displayed as commander-in-chief during the war. If victory then had meant preserving the Continental Army by avoiding battles that risked its survival, he had fashioned a kind of Fabian presidency that sustained the credibility of the federal government by avoiding political battles, the court system and slavery, for instance, that threatened to push federal sovereignty further and faster than public opinion allowed. And, just as he had once delegated control over the crucial military campaign in the South to Nathanael Greene, he had also delegated control over the crucial question of fiscal reform to Alexander Hamilton, who had performed just as brilliantly as Greene, while willingly absorbing the political criticism that would otherwise have been directed at Washington himself. The only major battle in which he had chosen to lead the charge personally and lost was the fight for federal jurisdiction over Indian affairs. But he did not regret that effort, which he continued to hope, perhaps like Brandywine or Germantown, would come to be regarded as a temporary setback on the longer road to ultimate victory. It was now time to resume his preferred role as Cincinnatus by declaring his heartfelt intention to retire at the end of his term. In conversations with several members of his official family during the spring of 1792, he described his declining energy and appetite for the demanding work schedule, his advancing years, his resolute sense that now was the time to go. In May, he called in Madison, reiterated his resolve, then asked Madison to draft a valedictory address, telling the American citizenry that he would not allow his name to be put forward as a candidate in the fall election. Madison protested the decision, as did all the members of the cabinet, but complied by preparing a 3-page statement in the format of an open letter to the American people that was aimed for release to the newspapers the following September. That letter, of course, never appeared, and Washington went on to serve a second term. The immediate reason for his decision, reached with great reluctance, became obvious in several spirited conversations with Jefferson and Hamilton during succeeding months, which exposed the widening chasm within his official family. Washington tried to treat the conflict as a fraternal spat between two of his surrogate sons. But the core of the disagreement, as Washington surely knew, went much deeper than that. Indeed, the only issue on which Jefferson and Hamilton could apparently agree was Washington's indispensability. Beyond that, Jefferson accused Hamilton of plotting to commandeer the government after Washington's departure, establishing his banker friends as a new American aristocracy and himself as king, emperor, or dictator, depending on Hamilton's whim. For his part, Hamilton charged Jefferson with working behind the scenes to undermine the Hamiltonian fiscal program and subvert Washington's policy of neutrality by aligning the United States with France, all part of a well-orchestrated Virginia conspiracy to capture the federal government for its slave-owning supporters. The hatred between the two men had become palpable, mutual, and personal. It had, in fact, been simmering for over a year, and only the patriarchal dominance of Washington's personality had prevented it from exploding earlier. While Hamilton managed to restrain his anger in consultations with Washington, the customarily serene Jefferson eventually lost his composure. He told Washington he could no longer allow his reputation to be clouded by the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country, which has not only received and given him bread, but heaped its honors upon his head. Although no one knew it at the time, indeed, no one yet possessed the vocabulary to talk or think about it sensibly, political parties were in the process of being born. The split between Jefferson and Hamilton was destined to foster the creation of the two-party system as a central feature in the American political universe. Though full-fledged parties with national platforms, campaigns, and conventions would not emerge until the 1830s, their embryonic origins first became visible during Washington's presidency. Over time, it would eventually become clear that a two-party system was a major contribution to modern political science. For by forcing the wide spectrum of political opinion into two camps, it institutionalized the ongoing dialogue into an organized format that routinized dissent. In retrospect, the two-party system has come to be regarded as one of the most significant and enduring legacies of the founding generation. But what is now seen as a great contribution was regarded by its creators as a great curse. And the man who did more to invent political